Arjuman Banu Begum, or Mumtaz Mahal, married Prince Khurram, better known as Shah Jahan, in 1612. Legend has it that Mumtaz Mahal was a devoted confidant and advisor to the emperor. So, in 1631, when Mumtaz Mahal died, giving birth to her 14th child, Shah Jahan was inconsolable for 2 years. Finally, coming out of his mourning, he channeled his energies into the building of a tomb in her name. We know it as the Taj Mahal. With me to take a walk through it and the Shah Jahani period are Salim Kidwai, a medieval historian from Delhi University, and Gita Wagle, a specialist who works in the decorative arts. Well, we're standing to one side of the Taj Mahal, amongst the flowers and trees, lush green lawns, and towering over us is the white onion dome of the Taj Mahal. Paradise, really. And in fact, that was the intention behind the Taj Mahal, wasn't it, Gita? To build a paradise on earth.
I think that this world that we live in, this planet, is paradise to those who can see. I mean, one can't really say specifically, but it might have been that Shah Jahan was a very enlightened person and therefore actually could see paradise on earth.
The style of sort of garden tomb, tomb surrounded by gardens, isn't new. The actual prototype of the Taj Mahal exists in Mughal monuments before the Taj. So there isn't anything very innovative about this building, except that it is perfection. It's the party dress of the Mughals, the best thing they could put on.
Mughal rule began in India with Babur, Shah Jahan's great-great-grandfather. Around 1526, Babur finally put aside any hopes of regaining his former homeland, Uzbekistan, and firmly established his hold on Indian soil. Harbans Mukhya, a medieval historian from Jawaharlal Nehru University in Delhi, paints a clearer picture of the Mughals.
First of all, the Mughals were one in a sequence of invaders who came and conquered and established themselves here. So it wasn't anything new that they were doing, and therefore they weren't really looked upon with any greater hostility than the earlier immigrants. Secondly, the Mughals brought to India with them something which was fairly unprecedented, namely an enormous amount of cultural creativity in almost every sphere of culture, in music, in painting, in architecture. Thirdly, the Mughals created a state system which was capable of, or which was seen to be capable of, establishing law and order, the like of which hadn't been done before. And therefore, they earned a great deal of legitimacy from the very fact of establishing law and order.
Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. أشهد أن لا إله إلا الله.
The Mughals were Muslim, certainly. It's also quite true that a very large chunk of the ruling class was Muslim. But it wasn't a Muslim empire as such. One could retain one's Hindu identity, or for that matter Christian identity, or a regional identity, and yet be part of a large Mughal ruling class. One doesn't have to give up one's Hindu identity in order to be incorporated into the Mughal Empire. The demarcating feature of the Mughal court is not Islam as such, but hierarchy. They are extremely conscious of hierarchy, which of course cuts across other identities. So that whether you are standing before the emperor, or whether the emperor allows you to sit before him, whether you sit on the right-hand side of the emperor or the left-hand side of the emperor, the distance between you and the emperor, etc., etc., all these are very, very significant indicators of proximity or hostility between you and the emperor, or for that matter, lower scale, between you and the provincial governor, etc., etc. So that it's hierarchy which is really the delineating feature of Mughal functioning, rather than being Muslim or Hindu.
Salim, we're sitting, well, on the edge of what is called the Mehman Khana, or the guest house, where actually not a lot takes place. It's largely for symmetry with the mosque, which is on the other side. Now, having explained that much of the Taj Mahal, will you describe the rest?
The Taj Mahal is in between the two and contrasts in material, because the rest of it is in red sandstone and the Taj is in shades of white. It's an octagonal building. not perfectly octagonal. The corners, sides are sharper, which makes it, I think, exceptional compared to other Mughal buildings. There is this element of fluidity that's constantly evident in the Taj Mahal, whether it's in the engravings, whether it's in the lines of the dome and the arches, whether it's in the minarets, which are not straight.
What is remarkable is that as you move closer or away from it, that's when the building actually really changes its dimensions, because the scale is so large and this platform that it's built on, and then you have a double sort of platform, but you, because you get down to the garden level, which is much, much lower. I find that is a much more interesting, you know, aspect to the Taj, rather than just this one symmetrical, perfect picture that everyone has. To me, it seems almost, apart from floating, it seems to be more like moving. As you move, it seems to be moving.
The Taj is also different in different lights. It's a different building in different lights. It's different at sunrise, different in the monsoons, it's different in the winters, it's absolutely different under a full moon.
Like a faultless, lustrous oriental pearl, the masterpiece among all the treasures of India lay dreaming, a white jewel enclosed in a frame of dark cypresses. The soft lines of the mighty marble dome and the defiant elevation of the four minarets formed an organic whole, so perfect, so instinct with beauty, that one involuntarily passed a hand over one's eyes, wondering whether it was not merely a beautiful dream or an unreal image.
What is a charbagh?
Charbagh is the concept of a tomb in the middle of a garden, which automatically divides off the rest of the garden into four segments. The Taj Mahal isn't a charbagh because one side of it is a river. So it's actually a three garden, a teen bagh, if you could say so. The concept of teen bagh doesn't exist. It borrows from the idea of a charbagh, but it is not a charbagh.
Having a river flowing by, you know, the eternal river of life, somehow gives it much more portent, rather than if you just stuck to the normal, formal layout of a charbagh, which would define the four basic elements, which is earth, fire, air, and water.
Shah Jahan used water as an architectural feature. If you look at some of his palace structures, you have water canals inside rooms that are private. Water also was used because of the use of fountains. It helped add opulence to the structure. It also added extra dimension by providing a reflection of the Taj, which is so perfectly framed in the canals in front of it.
My name is Wazar from the Transvaal in South Africa. And this is my seventh visit to the Taj. So you can imagine that how I like the Taj. That's why I'm every time here.
The Taj Mahal today attracts tourists from all over the world. So it's hard to imagine that once it was abandoned, virtually submerged, in the thicket of jungle surrounding it. Lord Curzon, a viceroy of India under British rule, finally decided to incorporate it into the grand lifestyles of the British Raj. But that wasn't until the early 20th century. And in fact, there was a time when the British, the new rulers of 17th century India, were very uncomfortable indeed to be reminded of those they had overthrown, as Harbans Mukhya explained.
Like all relationships, there is a delightful ambiguity in their relationship. On one hand, the British were trying to appropriate the legacy of the Mughal Empire. The Mughals were, after all, conquerors. So were the British. So there is a similarity and continuity. They were not merely inheriting the Mughal Empire, they were also changing the Mughal Empire, radically changing the structures of the Mughal Empire. Whereas the Mughals had really conquered the empire from their predecessors, the Lodis, and made changes, etc., etc., but the basic structures remained intact. The British fundamentally altered those structures. So the British Empire is not one of those medieval empires in India. It's a very, very different kind of empire. So, yes, so, and therefore the tensions that arose vis-a-vis the Mughals and vis-a-vis other elements of Indian society.
The Mughals ruled for over 200 years and the British ruled for nearly that length of time. Yet we still refer to the Mughals as rulers and the British as colonizers. What is the significance of that?
Well, basically, I think Mughals immigrated from what is now Uzbekistan and came and settled here and were incorporated here. They never went back. They never even thought of going back. And they never exported any part of India's wealth abroad. And therefore, they are, as it were, indigenized. They become part of Indian society. What marks the British conquest out is that the British didn't become part of Indian society. They didn't merge themselves in Indian society. India was a source of wealth for them, wealth which was being exported back into the United Kingdom.
Salim, is it really true that the British actually wanted to knock the Taj Mahal down and build something else on it?
They definitely wanted the marble to sell, and they did start, they did dismantle bits of the Red Fort, take the marble away, took the marble to England. They had started dismantling a bit of the Taj Mahal, which they stopped, thankfully, because marble didn't have a market in England. They then utilized it. I mean, I must say that they, Lord Curzon onwards, there was a concerted effort to maintain them because the importance of these monuments was realized. Before that, they were treated as curiosities. The British had parties on the platform of the Taj. There must have been great ones. They had live bands playing.
But do you think there was any envy in this, in wanting to demolish something as obviously as beautiful as the Taj, or was it just that people didn't like things of this style then?
No, the British, at least the early British rulers, did have a terrific inferiority complex as far as the Mughals were concerned. They didn't consider themselves in any way equal to the even the image of the Mughals, and they kept the facade of the Mughals alive for as long as they could. There was an element of malified vandalism here, the destruction of the remains of an empire that they felt was overshadowing their Raj.
Let's talk a little bit about the man who's kind of behind all this. What was Shah Jahan like as a person or a personality?
Not a terribly successful ruler. A building of this size and of this reputation naturally has a lot of myths around it, and myths about the builder also grow. And one of the myths about Shah Jahan is to raise him to the level of greatness that the Taj represents as a piece of art, which isn't so, because the Mughal Empire clearly was beginning to decline under Shah Jahan. The empire was contracting in some ways. They had lost their Persian outpost, never to recover it in Kandahar. There had been a disastrous campaign in Central Asia when Indian armies were sent across the Hindu Kush for the first time in its history, and the empire was running at a constant deficit. Shah Jahan was spending too much money on extravagances like this. I mean, this obsession with marble, for instance, was an indication of Shah Jahan's temperament, this temperament for the opulent. This was just symptomatic of the self-image of the Mughals and the high culture that the Mughal court had cultivated by this time, which was definitely a little beyond their means, as was shown by the constant declining revenues, the peasant rebellions which were beginning, the fall in agricultural production, and decline that set in Shah Jahan's time itself. I mean, you must remember that Shah Jahan was the only ruler who was deposed, only Mughal ruler who was deposed and had to spend his time in prison, because he let a fight break out between four of his sons. Fight between contenders for the throne wasn't unusual. It happened all the time in the Mughals. There was no definite law of succession. But under Shah Jahan, it was uncontrollable like everything else, like the opulence. I mean, there was a war that lasted 2 years, and then Shah Jahan survived the civil war to end up as a prisoner of his son.
To gain the throne from Shah Jahan, the kind of fight between the brothers, that was one of the bloodiest in Mughal history.
Bloodiest, certainly, and four brothers born of the same father and mother, literally slitting each other's throat, and one of them succeeding, and the other three having been killed by him. Two certainly, and one was lost.
The marble that we see on the Taj Mahal, it's only surface deep, isn't it? It's not actually solid.
It's not through and through marble, because that would have taken enormous amounts of marble and multiplied the costs a dozen times or so. Something that is obvious in Shah Jahan's other buildings, because he had so identified his own style with marble that he had to fake marble in some of his other buildings, where he used plaster and had it polished till it looked like marble.
The marble that came from Rajasthan for the building of the Taj Mahal, would that have been very expensive?
I presume so, because marble had just been, I mean, it wasn't really used extensively, except I'd say Rajput princes and Maharajas and things would build some palaces and so on. But to get this amount of quantity, I don't think we're really here talking about how expensive it was the marble itself, because it's not pure white marble. But we are talking about quantities. I mean, how many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tons have gone into this is, I wouldn't really be even able to calculate, I think.
And the transportation of that would have been a very delicate business.
Right, because it has to come all the way from Makrana, which is in Nagaur district, which is, I'd say, about how many hundreds of miles would you say, Salim?
300 or more.
And in those days, with bullock carts, 300 miles is a long way to come.
Way to go. And to maintain your control over the entire route, to be able to control the mines, which were obviously something that a lot of people must have been in contention for, the ownership of which had to be protected, it would have cost a lot.
The Taj Mahal may appear from a distance to be pure marble and textured at that, but as you move closer, you see a great deal of intricate artwork, both on the outsides and inside, around the arches of doorways, the cenotaphs, even the calligraphy or verses from the Quran are not written but inlaid into the walls in a form of artwork called pietra dura. So Gita, what exactly is that?
Well, pietra dura is the singular and pietre dure is the plural. So obviously if you're talking about a monument the size of the Taj Mahal, you'd obviously say pietre dure. Well, anyway, pietre dure is more or less semi-precious and precious inlay into marble or other stones. And on the screen, for instance, you'll see that there's a lotus, which isn't terribly big. It's about 2.5 inches across, and it's got about 64 little bits in it.
64 slivers of different kinds of stones.
It's all the same stone, but they're using different shapes to give you the actual feeling of the shape of the leaves and the way the leaves turn, which is what the Mughals did in actually when they were using pietre dure, is they've put in perspective in the actual design, which I think also is borrowed from the Italian lapidaries and the various pietre dure workers who obviously came from Italy to India. Because when you compare the Indian miniatures that predate the Mughals, the effect is much flatter. The Indian hand is used to doing much more fine work. You know, it's much more complicated and it's got much more convolutions. And where they use this very successfully is doing very, very fine, what we call nasila kam, which is actually vein work, to divide a leaf into, again, different sections and put in the actual veins into it. That work is not really done in Italy at all. And that, I think, is an Indian addition because of the fineness of our craftsmen here.
There are legends, and many there are, that the master craftsmen, some of them had their thumbs cut off, some of them had their eyes gouged out, or at least one eye gouged out, so that they could never repeat something of such beauty again.
Everywhere, but particularly in India, almost every monument, every building, almost every house has lots and lots of legends attached to that, you know. That's really the colorful part of Indian history, Indian culture, more than Indian history, Indian culture, really. So that these are delightful legends, but they are only legends. I mean, one should hear them, enjoy them, but shouldn't really place too much of reliance upon them, no.
Well, so let's go into the inner chamber where the tombs are of both Shah Jahan and Mumtaz Mahal. Now, what we're looking at is, in fact, the screen that surrounds the Shah Jahan and his wife Mumtaz Mahal. All that has been done in marble, hasn't it?
Yeah, the whole thing is marble, which has got fairly fine carving, which is a kind of a lattice jali work all around. But the actual frame is covered with various floral sort of renderings of actual
you know, plants and flowers. It looks yellow, but I guess that's not with intention, but with dirt, isn't it?
Because of, I mean, look at the thousands of people who have actually, you know, been visiting, and I think it's all, a lot of it is hair oil and hand oil, frankly. Because people actually, you know, they touch their heads to the railing in paying homage or whatever.
How long would it have taken, do you guess, to make this screen around the two tombs?
Well, the actual mausoleum was started around 1630, or 31 actually. And I'm told that there is a signature somewhere saying that it took about 22 years in all to complete. And just her cenotaph took about 11 years. And the screen also seems to have been completed in 1642. And we seem to have a date on that, on one of these walls somewhere, if we can find it.
Is there a lot of Pietra Dura on the screen and around the tomb here?
Yes, I'd say that pretty much, I mean, the inside main dome of the Taj Mahal has got pretty extensive Pietra Dura work. I mean, particularly on the cenotaphs, as well as the inside and the outside of the screens, as well as the main door to the screen and the rear door, which is actually closed off. And also when you see all these different other walls, like the calligraphy, for instance, is also in Pietra Dura. The script is Nastaliq. And all of that is also black Belgium marble inlaid into white Makrana marble.
Around the tomb are also sung prayers known as the Fatiha. Salim, tell us, what exactly is that?
That's a series of verses from the Quran in a certain order that are meant to be recited for the good of the soul of the departed. They are said usually besides the grave on occasions like religious occasions like the Shab-e-Barat or the night that the Prophet ascended to heaven, or on occasions like the death anniversary of the person whose grave it is.
So in this case, Mumtaz or
Shah Jahan.
Now we're right down in the basement, and this is where the actual tombs are buried. Shah Jahan's tomb seems to be much bigger than his wife's. Do you think that was the way he would have liked it?
I'd expect it to be that. It's not a question of liking it, but it had to be larger because he's the one who built it and he was the king. But interestingly, Shah Jahan's cenotaph, or for that matter, Shah Jahan himself is the only person who ruins the perfect symmetry of this wonderful building. He's the only one who's out of place in this whole building because of the cenotaph.
Well, we'll talk about why when we get outside, because it's very hot in here.
We left behind with the legend of Shah Jahan as the lover, the man who would build something like this for a lover for a departed wife. You wonder how much of this is can be accepted, because I mean, this is a man who had thousands of other women in his harem. This is a man who liked opulence of every form. This is a man who most probably wanted even a grander monument for himself. He clearly had not planned to be buried in the Taj himself.
So what did he plan for himself?
God knows, I'd love to know. I'm sure it would have been something as much of a fantasy as this must have been.
But surely you're hedging. I mean, there are lots of theories, and one of them happens to be that there was supposed to be a black Taj Mahal built as a reflection to the white one across the river. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, that's a legend, which, as far as I'm concerned, I wouldn't dismiss, because Shah Jahan was perfectly capable of planning something as incorrigible as that.
Geeta, don't you get the impression that Salim doesn't really, you know, think that Shah Jahan was such a great man after all?
Yes, I do agree. You see, I mean, I think there is something to be said in the way of romance and true love. It seems that even if you have a harem of whatever number of X ladies, there is a definite possibility that just one of them, I mean, you know what we have about soul-to-soul contact and all that, there just might have been something of that kind, in which case it puts a completely different complexion on the whole matter. But that's a very personal opinion.
But it's a nice balance between cynicism and romanticism, isn't it? The Taj Mahal, dedicated by legend to love, has inspired many. But what about the lady behind the legend, Arjuman Banu Begum? Given her royal title, Mumtaz Mahal, on becoming queen, what was she like, Salim?
We know very little about her, except that she was extremely fertile. She had 14 children. We know very little about Mughal women in any case, because most history was recorded by men who had never seen these women. And most of it was conjecture. And most of it was conjecture by later historians and by bizarre gossip.
Well, for centuries, writers have attempted to portray a picture of this royal couple's love. Even in our times, the challenge cannot be resisted. In 1978, the American author David Carroll took us back to the Mughal Bazaar, where Prince Khurram first set eyes on his love.
Glancing past row upon row of bargaining courtiers and gaily colored tents, he caught a fleeting glimpse of Arjumand positioned near a niche in the corner of the marketplace. Within a moment, he was standing at her stall. He wished, he said, to know the price of the large piece of glass on the counter, the one that was cut to look like a diamond. It was indeed a diamond, she facetiously insisted, and its price was high, very high, 10,000 rupees. For a moment, Khurram remained motionless, looking steadily at the young woman, wondering, according to legend, why the court gossips had never spoken the name of Arjumand Banu Begum. Then, without a word, he drew 10,000 rupees from his sleeve, took the piece of glass, turned, and vanished into the crowd, carrying the stone and Arjumand's heart with him.
Remember, she came from a very influential family. She was the niece of the last queen. Her father and her brother were very important Mughal functionaries, very important generals. She also must have had some charisma and some other qualities that attracted Shah Jahan to single her out rather than any one of his other queens to build a monument over.
There seem to be so many myths and legends about how the Taj Mahal came to be. Do you think it is true that on her deathbed she whispered into his ear that she wanted a paradise on earth?
I think she died before he got to her.
Now, what do you think, Geeta? This is a soul-to-soul contact?
Well, I certainly think that there was something special between Shah Jahan and Mumtaz Mahal because of all these other myths and legends that you have. For instance, his hair supposedly have sort of gone white, well, I don't know, overnight or maybe in a year or whatever. But then there's also records of him having distanced himself from every day-to-day life. I mean, he became sort of an ascetic for at least 1 or 2 years for certain. And it's not likely if you don't really care that you are able to do this. So I think there must have been something special between them for sure.
जाने की जिद ना करो
आ गए हो